Hi, and welcome everyone to Investing for Generational Wealth. Let's dive into the world of expert financial insights and strategies. And before we begin, as always, a quick disclaimer. We're not financial advisors. Our investments are subject to risk, including the possible loss of money you invest. So perform your due diligence before making financial decisions. And of course, consult your CPA and your attorney before making any investments. So I'm here today. My name is John Lai. I'm your host. And welcome to today's episode, Managing Property Managers for Multifamily Properties. And today's guest is Christopher Lento. And Chris is the founder and managing member of VM Capital. He has a background in mechanical engineering from Carnegie Mellon University and professional development training at BU and MIT. And Chris brings a unique perspective to our multifamily real estate investment approach, as you'll find out today. He has over 20 years of experience in multifamily ownership, management, and investment for investing. His vision and guidance drives his team to remain dedicated to diversification and sustainable and socially responsible multifamily housing investments. Okay, and with that, thanks for being here with us, Chris. I'll give you a little bit of background on your experiences, but could you provide a little bit more detail on your background, how you got to where you are today?
Yeah, absolutely. And happy to be here, John. So, you know, as you mentioned, I have a mechanical engineering degree, master's in mechanical engineering as well. And I started working effectively in the aerospace industry right out of college in the Boston area. And no real background in real estate. Had a engineering project management job. And almost right away, you know, moved into an apartment in the Boston area, in Somerville, actually. And started thinking, you know, who owns this place? It's kind of a dump, and we're paying, you know, $2,400 a month between the four of us. And there's three levels. Boston has a lot of these three deckers, we call them, which is three apartments stacked on top of each other. And they're all over the place. So I just got curious and, you know, kind of made a little hobby of mine to start reading books about it and develop some Excel models. And it was pre-podcast era. Internet was there, but not great for, you know, this kind of thing. So mainly books and, you know, really got into it. So kind of while I'm starting my career, I'm researching this. And 2 years later, I bought a three-family apartment with an illegal kind of in-law in the basement in not a great area of town, which ended up to be a great area. But at the time, it was okay. Moved into that and started, you know, collecting rents and dealing with tenants and just sort of jumped right in. I was relatively handy. Like, you know, I can like do minor construction and kind of fix things. So I sort of didn't know what I didn't know and just jumped right into it. That ended up working out really well, kind of live rent free for a little while, then started making some actual money on it. And then saved up and bought another one, maybe a quarter mile away, a couple of years later, and moved into that one. You know, the nice part about these smaller residentials is that you can use like regular residential lending, right? So I was putting, right, you know, I think I put 5% down on my first deal and maybe 10% down on the second one because I was going to owner occupy it. And then, you know, renovated those, bought another five family. And then at this point I started thinking, all right, well, getting a little more serious, would I want to transition to this? And then the, you know, 2008, 2009 happened. And anyone that I knew in real estate that I was starting to make relationships with and think about, well, could I switch to like a W-2 job in real estate so I'm better aligned with this and then eventually make a transition, was like, if you have a job, hold on to it. Like, there's nothing right here for you. So, you know, that put a delay on things for a couple of years. And then around 2015, really, I kind of rose to the level in my company where I could see kind of the path. I could see, you know, what the job ahead of me was and where it went. And none of those really excited me. And I was like, oh, okay, I need to figure out a plan here. How can I do this thing that I like on the side full time? I transitioned all my properties to property management, even though maybe it wasn't the most economical thing to do. It freed me up and it gave me practice on, you know, how to hire property managers. What does it mean to have a property manager? What do they do? What don't they do? What are the fees? How to manage them? And then I bought another 5 unit out of the area. It's about an hour away, but I tried to treat it like it was remote. So I visited it like once a quarter. I had weekly meetings with the property manager. And I realized the freedom in that. So, you know, even a minor problem, I wasn't going to spend 2 hours round trip fixing it. So it made me, you know, rely on people to do those things, which was great, because the part I hated the most about owning and operating was just those nuisance calls, you know, and there's not many of them really, but they just hang on you. There could be one. You might have to go over to someone's house on a Sunday and like talk to people you don't want to talk to and do something you don't really want to do. So then I was investing in some other deals, and with my real estate, I had the confidence that I think I had calculated maybe I had a 2-year runway of money saved if I was tight, and quit. Well, actually started trying to ramp it up with my W-2 job, which was very difficult. You know, one thing about once you get into the larger properties is it's more of a 9-to-5 environment. You know, the brokers, the property managers, you know, anyone involved in those, we'll say 100 unit buildings, it's their day job. It's not their part-time job. So they don't want to talk to you at 8 o'clock at night. They don't want to talk to you on Saturday. That's, you know, that's not when they're working. And so it was hard to develop the broker relationships that I needed to kind of really grow. So I made the decision that I was going to take a risk and go full time. And one realization that sort of made that possible was, you know, I had a good reputation at my company. I didn't burn any bridges when I left. I could always go back. And I would say up to this day, probably every year, someone's like, "Hey, we got a job opening. You want to come back?" And I politely declined.
Right.
So it wasn't as big of a risk as I thought it was, I suppose. I guess it was a risk to ego, right? It didn't work out.
What year was that you made that job?
That was 2018.
2018, okay. Yep. So it was not early during 2018. It wasn't during any crisis per se.
Nope, like 2010 no crisis.
Yeah.
Nope. So, you know, went full time in 2018. I now have grown to a team of 4, including myself. We have 600 units under management all over the Southeast. So North, South Carolina, the Atlanta area, a couple in Kentucky, and one in Tallahassee. They range, as I kind of grew, they range from 24 units up to 144 units. And with, you know, different challenges along the way. And I think a lot of podcasts and education is around how to find a deal. And there's not a ton of people that focus on operating a deal and or asset management. And, you know, coming from large scale defense contracting, I did a lot of project management, and it sort of translates well to, you know, regular status meetings and key metrics and how to make sure you're going in the right direction. So, you know, I know that's what I'm here to talk about today, but it's been kind of a critical component of, I think, my success, and, you know, I enjoy it.
Yeah, that's great. Thanks for that extensive background. I think a lot of people in the same situation, W-2 employees, probably have that same mindset, right? They think they can do it themselves. Initially, they find that it's a little bit more time consuming, and with the W-2, it's becoming, you know, more and more difficult. I'd be interested to know the difference between a property manager of a residential property, or, you know, at least 4-ish, 5-ish type of property, to all the way through to like a large scale 100 plus unit property. Like, are there nuances to it? Are there personalities? Are there skill sets that it benefits one over the other?
Yeah, there absolutely are, and I think it's probably. I know that it's regionally dependent as well. So the type of housing stock that you have kind of drives who are the good property managers in your area. So I'll talk to 2 examples of that. So in Boston, we have. There's not a lot of single family rentals up here. So there's a lot of apartment rentals, and there's a lot of, large apartment, class A apartment rentals. And then there's a lot of these small, we'll say 3-to-5 unit buildings. And a huge percentage of those are not professionally managed. They're owner managed. So I would say finding someone to manage your small, say 2-to-4 unit is really difficult. and they kind of come up and they have a business for 2 years and they decide this business is terrible because, you know, it's hard to scale, and they disappear. So that is, it's difficult to find small property managers around here for these, say, one to five unit buildings. Now, in a place like Charlotte or Washington, D.C., where there's a lot more transient, a lot more people moving in, it's more spread out, and there's a lot of single family rentals. There's a lot of high quality property management in the single family rental space because there's a big demand. And I think it's actually kind of easy to manage single families in that when families move in, they sort of take ownership of the whole property. Like they might mow the grass right. and they might garden. So right. they sort of own the building. They stay a little bit longer. They'll change light bulbs. They'll do sort of smaller things because this is their kind of long-term home, where in an apartment building, they sort of view it as it's not my problem. So that's one space, sort of the real small space. And then we'll jump to the kind of, I'll say 70 plus units, depending on how much the rent is, where you have what I refer to or is called the on-site model. So you have an office, you have a leasing agent who sits in the office, you have a full-time maintenance person. Those are both effectively, you're paying their salaries, you know, through the property management company. So you're paying a property management company to kind of do the back end, the books, to hire those people, to manage those people. But you're also like paying their salary. Right. And they're dedicated. So they're there every day. And that is, there's a lot of good quality property managers in that space. They're professional. They have, you know, accountants, they have bookkeepers, they have maintenance managers, you know, across their portfolio, depending on the size. So that's, I think, a relatively easy space to find quality property management. Not, you know, you still have to manage them and stay on top of them. But the in-between space, I have found very difficult. So sort of above that condo focused person, condo or single family, and below that, that like on that the size that can support an on-site. And, you know, it's typically called an off-site property manager. So they, you know, you have a leasing agent that you deal with, or maybe a key point of contact that you deal with, but they're dealing with tons of other buildings. There's no dedicated maintenance. You know, they're subcontracting a lot depending on how big they are. Maybe they have in-house plumbing and handyman. Maybe they don't. Maybe they just call the local, you know, plumber to unclog your drain. So those I find the most challenging and the most variable, I guess.
Yeah. Would you say that would be enough to dissuade you from, for example, if you were looking to acquire additional property?
It would be enough.
Yeah.
Yeah, it would be enough to buy an additional property of that size in an area that I don't already have one of those vetted.
Right.
So, you know, I have a good one in Charlotte. I would consider buying another property that size if it was a great deal in Charlotte. But I wouldn't go to a new market that I don't have someone that I trust and know in that space. Because it's just, in that space, I've gone through a number of property managers. Whereas in the top, the bigger space, we've been with really the same ones, you know, since we purchased the assets.
Got it. Okay. Could you talk about characteristics to look out for, both in that space as well as like the 75 unit, 100 unit plus of property managers?
Right. Yeah. So for the 100 unit plus, I think scale is important. You know, having the layers of in-house management such that, you know, they can do, you know, say 15 roofs. You know, they have the connections where they can go get a good price on doing 15 roofs in a 2 month time period. And they're not like scratching their head, well, I don't know if my guy can support that kind of scale. Right. Additionally, it's nice in that space if they have multi regions, right? Like if they do the whole Southeast, there's a huge benefit of having the same property management company do our property in South Carolina that does our property in Atlanta. So we have, you know, similar points of contact. The back end bookkeeper who does our books is the same person. The reports look the same. The software is the same. I mean, there's a lot of benefits of having that kind of larger scope. And then I think you really also kind of the converse of that, you want to make sure that they do really know the market, right? Being on the edge of the market of one of those bigger companies, you know, so say they're focused in Atlanta and you're maybe in Virginia, how much do they have in that area? How far is that from home base? Do they really know the market, or are they trying to expand into that market? And, you know, maybe you're just looking to get new business. So I think those are kind of two key things. And, you know, I think price is a consideration, but this is it's a small profit margin business. And I think they've been sort of beat down to, you know, the bare minimum. So I don't see a ton of price variations, although there are kind of hidden prices that different property manager groups sort of have that you have to, you know, make sure you're paying attention to.
Conversely, what are things that you watch out for? What are like gotchas that are red flags to you that you should be or you typically watch out for?
Red flags. Well, in that middle space, there's a lot of fees happening that you may not know about. So for example, some of those property managers will split the late fees with you. Some will take all of the late fees. Very rarely will they let you take the late fees.
Right.
Which is sort of an interesting, I don't know, dynamic. So that's interesting. Yeah. And I've had a number of property managers that's in that space just tack on resident fees without me knowing. So, you know, we have a new program where we change your air filters and boost your credit and do concierge move-ins when you move in, hook up your electrical for you, you know, and it's $40 a month required. And I had a property that happened and I wasn't aware of it until noticed I was checking out their marketing of my property and I got none of that.
Yeah.
You know, so they outsourced it to a third party who did all those things for $20 a unit per month.
Yeah.
And then the property management company got $20 per unit per month and I got nothing. and that is, you know, so effectively my rent is cut by $40 a month because I don't think the prospective tenant cares about any of that. Right.
Right.
Just number they're paying per month and it's $40 higher than what I'm getting. So I've seen that a lot in that middle space. So that's definitely something to watch out for, kind of how are they making money? And I think in general, that's something to try to figure out, right? If someone comes in and says, oh, I'll give you a, you know, it's an offsite property management arrangement and the fee is 6% or 5.5%, you're like, well, that's really good. How are they making any money? Because you want them to make money, right? Like you don't want them to negotiate them down to a point where they don't like your property or it's a loss to them. They're not going to care about it. They're not going to pay attention to it, or they're going to get their profit somewhere else without you, you know, understanding that.
Right.
So that's a red flag.
That's a red flag. Yeah. Are there any that you can think of that when you first started out, you're like, wow, I wish I would have known that when I first started. But now that you do know that, you know, you look for that type of information. I guess, is there a story that kind of illustrates that?
Yeah. Well, one is it's very hard to get in that mid space again. The more tertiary the market, there may just not be property management in that area that's any good. I have a property in Kentucky, about 40 minutes south of Louisville. And we finally, after 4 years, have a quality property management company. And that's been the entire problem with the property. It's a great deal. We got a good price on it. It's a good asset. It's in high demand. The original company kind of said they could do it, but they were not interested and they basically couldn't. We fired them, brought in another local guy again. Now he was offsite. We'd, you know, go down there and check it out. And it was clear that nothing was being done. I mean, like negligence. Finally had to hire W-2 employee, full-time on-site manager, a full-time handyman. That was the most successful financially of the arrangements thus far, but it was a heavy lift for me because I was the back office, right? I mean, there was a leasing agent and a handyman and they did their part, but I learned, you know, AppFolio pretty well and more than I wanted to. And did a lot more than I was expecting and really want to do in that arrangement. And then finally, a new kind of owner moved into the area and is buying things up. And they're doing third-party management kind of to help them scale. And just recently, we came on them. So I would say, like, make sure that you are confident before even putting your offers in that there's quality property management in that area. Because if you're in Atlanta or Charlotte, you know, There will be. But if you're in a tertiary market, there may not be. And someone who says that they're fine, you know, managing from 50 minutes away, they'll think through what that really means, right?
Right. What is a typical team, property management team, look like? I know it's probably different if you're talking about, you know, 75 plus unit properties versus that middle tier. But if you can talk to maybe the larger units, properties first, like there's typically a non-site, right? There's a leasing agent and so on and so forth. What does that makeup look like?
Yeah, so it's like on our 144 unit in Atlanta, there's a on-site kind of head leasing agent or property manager. She has an assistant leasing agent who really just reaches out to leads, does showings, all about kind of marketing and responding to leads. There's a full-time handyman or maintenance manager, and then a half-time maintenance manager. So those are four people that are on site. One of them's part-time, the other three are full-time. And then in addition to that, there's a regional manager who has six apartment complexes in the area, and it is the boss effectively of that on-site property manager. And then on our weekly calls, the regional attends, the on-site attends, and the leasing agent attends. And we have a Zoom call, you know, with that group. And then above that is the regional VP, who sort of has purview over the whole area. And then depending on the company, you know, the regional VP will be on, at least in the beginning, on our weekly calls quite a bit. And they're sort of, if they know we're growing, which we are, they're sort of our main point of contact. They're kind of business development in a way. So they want us to be happy so that when we get our next property, we automatically go to them. So they're sort of, you know, they're upper management, but we can use them to affect change in a direction we want. And they often have purview over a larger area as well. So they'll know, say, maybe like the person who's doing signs really good right now, you know, with a good price and is not backed up, so that, you know, and maybe it's, you know, 50 miles away, but they'll have that kind of scope that they can source kind of the vendors for the more specific items and bring in some resources from the company that maybe the regional doesn't have access to. So yeah, that's sort of the 140 unit staffing. And then really, as you go up, you get more leasing agents and you get more maintenance staff. And I've been meaning to kind of think through like what the tiers are for that, you know, like, cause it's some optimal, right? Like at 100, I have a 60 unit, actually I have 113 unit that has just a leasing agent, no assistant, and just a maintenance person and no assistant. And that property runs really well. So I would say that's probably a sweet spot. You know, if she had another 15 units, I think she would need an assistant, which would bring up the overhead.
Right.
So
right.
I think there are some sweet spots in that, in the size.
Yep. You talked about tools, and not necessarily like as an owner, you want to use the tools like AppFolio, but like what are tools that property managers typically use that you might have used in the past or gotten access to in the past?
It's actually been very interesting. The last, I would say, since COVID, really, the number of kind of third-party prop tech tools that are being integrated into property management has really grown. So, you know, every property manager has a property management software, whether it's typically for the bigger properties, it's Yardi or Entrata or Resman. And then the smaller properties, you know, AppFolio team seems to be a dominant one, but there's a number of other ones. But then in addition to that, I mean, they have a layers of third-party tools and software on top of that. You know, there's something called NOC that measures, you know, how well they're engaging with leads. So it sort of takes phone calls, it takes internet leads, it takes text leads, it takes any kind of social media lead coming in, and then just watches how fast they're responding to that and then what they're saying, so that you get like a response rate within 48 hours. So that's one thing. There's, I mean, if you look at the administrative expenses line, I mean, it's like, what is all this stuff? And you know, and that's one thing on the bigger companies, you don't have much to say about that. Like they have the way they do it. Now you can add things in. And I, in the last, since COVID, I mean, so during COVID, you just needed to put a for rent sign or post something at apartments.com, and people were knocking down the door to come in at, you know, 12% rent increase over what you had. Since then, you know, people have to learn how to lease again and how to market again.
Right.
And then, so I think you have a mini generation of property managers that didn't have to market. And then you feather on top of that, all these new marketing softwares, software platforms that are out there. So we found that as owners, we've introduced to the property managers a number of tools that have been beneficial. You know, one property manager and company will have something and we'll say, oh, we'll go to a different one. And, you know, hey, have you tried this out? There's some good AI leasing software out there right now that gets prospects, you know, responses that are, you know, more tailored to the question they asked quicker. It prompts them to schedule a tour, prompt, you know, once they schedule a tour, reminds them of the tour. So there's, you know, kind of thousands of exchanges going on that now that assistant leasing agent doesn't have to do. So they can focus on really the high value add parts of that leasing cycle. So yeah, there's a lot of ancillary tools and growing.
My question is about tools that property managers can put in place, not so much how they manage their operations, but for the benefit of tenants. And how much of that do you get involved in versus the property manager saying, you know, it might be useful to, not necessarily technologies, but maybe there's a, you know, coin operated laundry facility that you can put in place, or maybe there's additional parking that, you know, you can put in place, or maybe it's as simple as charging higher rents. You know, how much of that do you see on a day-to-day basis, not day-to-day, but like maybe weekly basis as you have that planning meeting, versus you just let the property managers take care of that?
It's a balance. So, you know, when you're in the acquisition phase and you're working with the property manager, you're working with that more business development person, and they're like, oh, we could put covered parking here, and we could add coin op, and we could, you know, do all this. And you know, you're kind of like taking that in and figuring out your business plan at the same time. And maybe you'd already pencil that in or not. And you know, allocating capital or not allocating capital for that. But I would say once you transition into regular management, you know, they'll do quarterly market surveys on what the market rent is, but unless you're on top of it and raising it as an issue, they're unlikely to raise the rents without prompting. It's I have not found a property manager yet that is like, oh, we just had a quarterly rent, you know, thing, you know, review, and we think we can raise across the board $50. They will say that, but it's not unprompted. It's always me saying, what's the quarterly look like? You know, that looks like there's some room there. I think we could, you know, what do you think? And there's pushback and sometimes there's not pushback, but I've had properties where, you know, almost every time I ask that, the answer is, I think we could probably raise them $20 across the board. And I mean, like literally like 3 weeks later, I ask the same question. They say the same thing. Like, this can't be infinite, right? And then as far as other income opportunities, that's asset management. I mean, you might get a couple off the cuffs, but rarely, actually never do I get any sort of well thought out, like, hey, here's a new revenue stream that you haven't thought of. We think we can do this. No, I mean, that's the asset manager's job. And it's really, hey, or even pushing them, you know, we would like to develop some new revenue streams. You know, is there interest in storage? Is there interest in valet trash? What do you think about this? I mean, that tends to be from us. And then if it does come from them, there's usually a property manager benefit angle. It's usually from their upper management, and they're usually getting a cut.
Right. And I wonder how much it is due to incentives or disincentives. Like the KPIs that you set with the property management company, you know, you have to hit like 90% vacancy, and you know, so they're working toward that KPI versus and that's, you know, that's a key metric for them, versus additional revenue streams. It's not a KPI for them. Like, they're not, it's even not in the back of their mind. They're just trying to hit those KPIs.
I think that's got a lot to do with it. And I also think it's, you know, it's an operations job. It's just the definition of an operations job. So it's not a new idea job. you know, an on-site property manager, you're putting out fires, you're turning the crank, you're getting, you know, responding to your leads. I don't think they have a whole lot of time to really sit back and say, you know, what else could we do here that would generate revenue? One thing we do is the on-site people get bonuses based on, you know, how well they adhere to their budgets, and that's outside of our control, right? So the property management company sets targets for them, and sometimes they're transparent with that and sometimes they're not, as far as, you know, whether we know what they are. And then we usually put something on top of that that just says, you know, we know we budgeted to this growth, but if we can hit this NOI number by the next quarter, you know, each one in the in-house staff gets $500 or the, you know, the upper management and the in-house gets $500 to kind of get everyone aligned. And that's been very helpful on properties that are doing kind of well and just need to be tweaked. And the ones that, you know, are really struggling, it's always tougher because they're in the weeds and they're kind of doing whatever they can. And a lot of times our goals are too high to meet. But we have not ever said, you know, you're incentivized to come up with a new stream of revenue. That's a good idea.
Yeah. How did you learn about property management? So, I mean, obviously you did a lot of it yourself initially with residential. Were there books, were there mentors or like anything else that you listened to or watched that helped you, you know, understand the success of property management?
You know, there really haven't been. It's been sort of like learned by doing. You know, I'm not sure if I would have, you know, gone 3 units, 5 units, 15, 20 units, you know, if I was to do it again, because a lot of people are very successful just jumping right over all that and doing bigger properties. But I do feel like it gives me kind of a lot of insight into kind of what it takes. I mean, you know, at a gross level, like I know what a hot water heater costs and what it roughly should cost to install it. And it's, you know, if it's $5,000, someone's lying to me. But yeah, I think just from, you know, doing it at the physical level in the beginning, poorly, I might add, in retrospect, you know, I wasn't doing market surveys once a quarter and like raising rents to market. I was just, you know, not doing that, I guess. But I think really taking lessons from one property and then moving, you know, running them by the property managers at other properties and then sort of like kind of keeping that cycle going has given me a lot of insight. So sort of bringing best practices back and forth. You know, I have 8 assets right now and there's 4 property management companies running those. So, you know, each one does it a little different. The smaller ones tend to be less industry standard, sort of like just kind of doing what they think is best versus the larger ones tend to perform things similarly. I've not found any good resources though for asset management, I guess.
Yeah. Yep. I know there are a few books that not off the top of my head, I can't name of any, but there are a few on property management, but you're right. I mean, there's nothing that is a good substitute for experience. When you think about acquisition, so switching paths now, like when you're acquiring a property, there's an existing property management company on there. How much of that do you take into consideration? And then like, what are other considerations as you think about acquisitions and acquisitions vis-a-vis property management?
Yeah, so I guess I've never kept a property manager on a property that I'm acquiring. Not that I wouldn't, but you know, I'm a value add investor. So I'm typically looking to, you know, improve management, renovate, do CapEx, and the kind of properties that I buy typically are maybe not poorly managed, but not optimally managed. And then additionally, I guess I just have not kept a property. I'm not opposed to it, but it wouldn't, it hasn't come up. But I will say for the larger properties in the Southeast, you know, we use our existing property management to really support us in our underwriting and to do our due diligence. So they're, you know, we're feeding them deals as we get, you know, closer to, I guess, submitting a serious LOI or maybe even best and final. You know, we're running our full underwriting by them and we're saying, hey, are these market rents achievable? You know, you're likely going to manage this. Can you hit these numbers? You know, are these, what are these operating expenses look like for, can you get your regional in this area to evaluate them? So they're, you know, they want us to get the deal, but they know that they're going to be held accountable to those numbers because they helped us, you know, come up with them. And then, you know, when we do get the deal under contract, we typically do an early access agreement. So as we're hashing out the purchase and sales agreement, we go in there with the property management team. They typically bring sometimes up to 8 people, and we'll do a full physical and lease audit. So the you know, the financials team sits down with their property manager and they just go through and make sure that rent roll is equal to leases and go through all their accounts receivable and make sure, you know, what the software is saying is consistent with what their books are. And then their physical team will go into every unit. They typically have like this app that is set up for that. So they, you know, hit next, it goes to the next unit number. They take a picture of the door. They take a picture of like the 8 key things. It all goes into a report at the end. And then they'll have, you know, someone with a drone looking at the roofs and maybe like their local landscaper that they work with kind of walking the property and flagging dead trees and asphalt and all that kind of stuff. So before we even sign the PSA, our property management team, for a pretty minimal fee, I mean, like $2,500, will crawl all over the place and, and, you know, give us the confidence that we can go in and maybe put some money hard day one or hard with some minimal contingencies. So that's a huge value. And if you know, we didn't have that relationship, that we wouldn't be able to be as confident with our offers.
Yeah, that's great. Yeah, I mean, we've always seen property managers as partners as well, like the partners in basically supporting our business model and business case that when we put together an offer. So I definitely concur with that. How do you know, what KPIs do you use or do you look at when you're evaluating properties for value add specific to property management? Like, how do you know they're not hitting the mark? Is it primarily vacancies and, you know, maybe how what their past dues are and so forth?
Yeah, I mean, you know, we'll look at what their bad debt is, what their vacancy rate is, what their market rents are, what their recent lease ups are. You know, your ideal deal is it's run well, right? Like the operations are getting done, the maintenance is getting done. Maybe it's expensive, or that doesn't really matter that much, especially if we're going to bring our own team. So we sort of have an estimate of the operation costs. But they're, you know, they're relatively full. They're just unrenovated and below market. That's your their holy grail, right? So your market rents are 1,000 and they're 100% occupied at 90 at 900, and they're all classic. Like, that's great. You have room to raise the rents just as they are, and you have a value add story where you can get 1,200 if you do renovations. But yeah, as far as the kind of the key, I mean, at the end of the day, it's all in, what are our assumptions? What are our, you know, assumptions of operating expenses, assumptions of revenue growth, value add component? Like, what is it that we're doing to increase the NOI, which is at the end of the day, what the value add is, to hit our target returns.
Got it. I think that was my last question. Any parting thoughts before we close?
I think, you know, it's like anything, relationship building and communication is key. And, you know, one thing I've noticed recently is a couple of my property managers are doing our meetings with the Zoom off, and and we're like, hey, we really want to see your faces. And, it does help to see all these people on a weekly basis, and you start knowing their kids' names or like what's going on in their lives. And it does make that a mini team. So, you know, so my company's only 4 people, but if you sort of expand it out into the property managers, you know, you could argue it's like 20 people. I know what these people are up to, and then there's a culture that gets generated where they want to do their best for us as a team. They start liking us, and you know, we want to do our best for them as well.
Do you, on your team, do you have one person that primarily is responsible for managing the property managers, like either operations or?
We have a head of operations, but I also do a good amount of that. So I sort of like overlap and do maybe like the bigger like insurance claims or the CapEx projects or the we're suing someone right now. I'm doing that. you know, kind of the bigger items.
Got it. Okay. Well, perfect. Thank you very much for the time that you spent with us, Chris. Learned a ton. To learn more about managing property managers for multifamily properties, feel free to reach out to Chris. His email is chrislento@emcapitalgroup.com. We'll include his contact information in the description for this episode, as well as finding a new podcast. And of course, you can find us where you find your normal podcast. Again, thanks for educating us on managing property managers. We learned a ton. Don't forget to like and subscribe to our webcast or podcast on whichever platform you're listening to. Make sure that we can continue bringing you the best educational content. And thank you, everyone. Until next time, keep learning for investing for generational wealth. Thanks, Chris.
Thank you.